Mr. Murray, please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We took that break so you could condense your argument. What do you think about that?
I'll rely on what everyone said so far. Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. So I've heard the word adversarial almost every other word all afternoon, and I think it's important to recognize that the concept that there might be an examination that takes place under a Rule 4:19 examination as part of the adversarial process does not make the actual examination inherently adversarial, at least not any more than the examination that the plaintiff's expert performs on the plaintiffs themselves. If you want to change the language to some extent, the interests are certainly equal. The plaintiff has a somewhat collusive nature of a relationship with the expert that's examining the plaintiff that is certainly equal to the potential of an adversarial relationship between an examiner and examinee with a Rule 4:19 examination. Given the current language of 4:19 as it was amended in the year 2000, I believe that the appellate court unanimous decision, as discussed in 31-page opinion written by Justice Sabatino, should be upheld in its entirety. I think that it cuts the best possible compromise between what's otherwise an unequal process, where the plaintiff can send their client to be examined by the experts of their choosing without giving notice. They don't even have to tell us if they decide not to use the examination. They can send the client to 100 different neuropsychologists and never tell us once about it until they find the neuropsychologist that's going to cooperate with them. And I think, neuropsychology is the issue in two out of the three cases here, and I don't think that that's purely coincidental. It does provide us with a very tangible demonstration as to why the decision to allow the trial courts to consider the facts of each case on a case-by-case basis was the appropriate decision rendered by the unanimous appellate panel. Having a presumption of third-party observation or recording of a neuropsychology evaluation under Rule 4:19 would create an enormous disbalance in the equities between the plaintiff and the defendant. Neuropsychologists are almost always used for litigation purposes only, for the plaintiff or the defendant. So anytime the plaintiff sends their client to be seen by a neuropsychologist or multiple neuropsychologists, the defendants do not have the opportunity to see what is done during that evaluation. Plaintiffs are asking for a blanket presumption that they be permitted to have TPO or recording devices at any examination performed on behalf of the defendant. And the way this can play out, or the way that it would play out, is you would have the issue where plaintiffs, as has become relatively routine, demand third-party observation or recording devices at a Rule 4:19 neuropsychologic evaluation, knowing that many neuropsychologists will refuse to perform those evaluations given the standards as voiced by the various governing boards, one represented by the Attorney General's office in this case. In many of their papers, I see the plaintiffs over and over again saying, well, neuropsychologists can't be sanctioned for doing this. We don't think that there's grounds for them to be able to discipline a neuropsychologist for performing an evaluation with third-party observation or recording devices. But all the literature, even the literature they produce, says that it's contrary to good practice. A brief description of what a neuropsychological evaluation is would be helpful, I think. The series of tests that are conducted by the neuropsychologist are tests that have been carefully calibrated and developed under controlled circumstances. So what this literature is saying, among other things, is that one of the reasons we don't want neuropsychologists to perform evaluations with third-party observers or recording devices is that's not how it was calibrated. If the neuropsychologist performs its testing in accordance with the same controlled conditions under which the tests have been calibrated, they have a high degree of confidence in the results of the tests, and they can say to a reasonable degree of medical probability that this is an objective assessment of what the plaintiff's cognitive or mental condition is. And if there's a deviation from the standard practice, which is what the plaintiffs are trying to force the neuropsychologists to do, they have less confidence in the results because that's not how the testing was calibrated. Importantly, a valuable part of the neuropsychologic evaluation, a component that is rarely used by neuropsychologists retained by plaintiff's counsel, are a series of validity scales that are embedded in the tests that are administered. The validity scales will tell you whether or not, objectively, whether or not the plaintiff is trying to influence the test by underperforming or attempting to skew the results. So, if you have a case where a defense expert who performs a Rule 4:19, well, you have the defense counsel sending the notice for a Rule 4:19 neuropsych evaluation. You have the plaintiff's attorney saying, we were requiring under this new presumption that we can have third-party observers or recording devices, that our client be able to bring in a third-party observer or recording device. And the defense counsel talks to the neuropsychologist who says, no, look, I'm aware of the position the attorney general took in this recent Supreme Court case, and I'm aware of this literature that says that the validity of my reports will be challenged. The defense attorney then is stuck with two choices. The defense attorney can forego the entire field of neuropsychology and never get a neuropsychologic evaluation, or the defense attorney can send the client to have the neuropsych evaluation with the TPO or recording device. Under that circumstance, number one, the pool of neuropsychologists willing to perform under those circumstances is much smaller. Two, the results are less valid. Three, it's being conducted under conditions that the plaintiff's attorney does not have to abide by. They don't have to tell us about the neuropsych, the 50 or so neuropsych evaluations that they send their client to and never use.
But isn't that the case in all 21 states where this is already the rule? So, for example, in Florida or New York or California or wherever, the other states that were listed, do they just never use neuropsych evaluations because of all the issues you're saying?
Your Honor, I've never practiced in any of those states, but what I could anticipate was that even in those other states, if I send my client to get a neuropsych evaluation and there's a third-party observer present or there's a recording device present, at the time of trial, the plaintiff is going to pull out the attorney general's brief from this case and start questioning the expert and saying, was anybody else present during your evaluation? And they'll say, yes. Were you aware that the Attorney General, on behalf of the New Jersey Board of Psychologic Evaluators, has stated in a brief that they submitted to the Supreme Court that your results are not valid? Are you aware that the ABN position, that the American Board of Professional Neurology has issued a position paper that states that it is the position of the American Board of Professional Neuropsychology that altering test procedures to accommodate observation or recording compromises test standardization and affects the subsequent data set obtained? Are you aware that the plaintiff's expert did not have third party present? Are you aware that the plaintiff's expert did not have a recording device?
Is this something present? That it can be dealt with in a protective order? Because can a trial court, and you're raising, I think, an important point, can a trial court essentially anticipate that there, to the extent that this third-party presence at the request of the plaintiff is being is potentially a an impeachment issue in the cross-examination of the expert, that's not going to be admissible.
Your Honor, that would potentially mitigate that final point about cross-examination. It would not mitigate the idea that plaintiffs will have a broader pool of neuropsychologists to pull from, that the plaintiffs' reports will actually have arguably more validity because they were done under standardized procedures.
Would a reciprocal rule that allowed the same, we're not talking about the treater that the person has seen since the accident, but we're talking about the neuropsychologist who's retained for purposes of eventually testifying, would a rule that allowed you the same relief of having either a third person in the room or recording address that issue?
It would mitigate the issue to the extent that we would both be dealing with experts who are giving opinions rendered under less than ideal circumstances. The word aspirational showed up again and again in some of the plaintiff's written submissions, somehow suggesting that an expert who holds their standards to an aspirational level should somehow be disregarded because they have not done enough to potentially be sanctioned by the Board of Psychiatric Specialties. I think we would all prefer to have experts who are practicing to the aspirational standard and give us the results that that are rendered to the best of their professional ability.
So which specific neuropsychological or neuropsychologist ethical standard bars third-party observation or recording, or are you simply referring to the American Board of Neuropsychology 2016 guest editorial?
And I think the characterization as a guest editorial is a bit dismissive, particularly given the fact that the New Jersey Board of Psychological Examiners has endorsed that as establishing a standard, but, and that the Attorney General has stated that that is a standard for the profession.
But so we'll have an opportunity to question the counsel for the Attorney General's office as well. But in this specific case, assuming it wasn't, what do you characterize it as?
This specific case, Your Honor, I have a specific neuropsychologist who I use, who I respect, and who has a fantastic CV, as I think the plaintiff's attorney went over earlier, and that expert said that it's against my understanding of my professional ethics to perform an examination with a recording device or a third-party observer because of various concerns, one of them being test validity, that I will not have the same level of confidence in these testing results if I do not conduct the test under the optimal conditions and recording.
Does that single expert's conclusion go beyond what the policy statement from 6-7 years ago says?
No, Your Honor, I think it's consistent with the policy statement.
The policy statement appears to allow family members, guardians, family friends, interpreters as necessary. It appears to allow for protective orders and the conducting of an examination. It doesn't have a bright line rule that this shall never happen.
It does not have a bright line rule that it shall never happen, but it certainly encourages neuropsychologists not to do this unless they absolutely have to, and that it's suboptimal.
What ethical rule would be violated today by someone conducting an exam in the presence of a third party or an unobtrusive recording device?
Your Honor, aside from ethical rules, what we're talking about is allowing the defendant equal opportunity to hire the expert of their choosing who will perform their evaluation in accordance with good practice as they understand it. They're in the best position, and Judge Sabatino's opinion allows these issues to be discussed with the trial court on a case-by-case basis, to weigh whether the experts' concerns about these prohibitions are outweighed by the need for an observer in this case and not in that case. There are plenty of Rule 4:16 19 examinations where the standards of the various professionals don't give them pause one way or the other about third-party observer or recording. It just so happens that neuropsychology has been one of those professions that is highly reliant upon the manner in which the testing is administered, and that the ability for the practitioner to have full confidence in their results lies in the way that they administer the tests. And to say that the plaintiff's attorney, or that there is a blanket presumption that they should have to perform their evaluations in a manner that's inconsistent to what they think their best practice is, is something that shouldn't be condoned. It's something that can be dealt with on a case-by-case basis. We're not asking for, and the appellate division did not issue an order saying it's a blanket rule that third-party observers or recording devices are never allowed. All they said was this should be considered on a case-by-case basis.
And note that the piece from 2016 makes reference to articles from the decade before. Does it adequately account for advances of technology as we discuss this question in 2023?
Your Honor, I don't practice neuropsychology. I'm going by what the Board of Psychology has stated, and by what my expert has stated, and by the literature that has been identified by those experts in the field.
Are you also dealing with the best experts are sometimes adverse to anything that might cast the slightest doubt on not only their competence and qualifications, but on their position as someone at the top end of their field. And they're very sensitive about exposing themselves to cross-examination along those lines.
I think there are these published standards. I mean, they're written as standards. They've been adopted. They've been referenced in the updates that have been provided. They're talking about test security. They're talking about the validity of the results. They're not talking about, we're not allowing this because we don't want to expose our practitioners to scrutiny. They're saying this is the best practice. This is, and plaintiff's counsel's phrase, this is the aspirational standard that we're giving to you. This is what you should shoot for. If you're a practitioner that wants to practice in the best manner as a neuropsychologist, this is what you should follow. You should administer these tests in the exact same way that they were calibrated, and then you can stand up in front of a jury and say with a high degree of confidence that your results are true to a reasonable degree of medical probability. And that's what my expert sought to do in this case. That's what the position of the Attorney General has been in on behalf of the New Jersey Board of Psychologic Examiners. And I think to have a blanket presumption and not to allow the trial courts to consider these things on a case-by-case basis would be unfair to the analysis that went into the 31-page opinion that was issued on behalf of the unanimous appellate panel. As to there were six discrete rulings issued by that panel. The plaintiffs' counsel here collectively want two of them to be revisited, the issue of whether or not there should be a blanket rule rather than a case-by-case basis, which I think is what we've dealt with almost exclusively today, and who should bear the burden appropriately.
What if the court were only to address the second and change the second of the six findings that Judge Sabatino included in his holding?
The second as to who bears the burden?
Yes.
Your Honor, I think that the rule is clear on its face that, number one, since 2000, which is the amendment in 2000 is one of the primary motivators for Justice Sabatino's opinion on that issue, that granted defendants the right to have a plaintiff who voluntarily places their physical or mental condition in controversy, to have that individual subject to the examination of the expert specifying the time, place, manner of the examination, and that the plaintiff, an uncooperative party has available to them the ability to move pursuant to Rule 10, 4:10-3 for a protective order. And there's a good cause standard under the rule for a protective order for a plaintiff who wishes to impose conditions on a Rule 4:19 examination. It's clear in the face of the rule that it's the plaintiff who bears the burden to show why the examination should be performed under conditions different than that which the medical professional believes to be consistent with their standards of care.
Why is that clear from the rule? I understand the rule says that the defendant can force the plaintiff to undergo this examination, but it doesn't also say and no third party can be present, or and it can't be recorded, and it's up to the doctor to decide if they want it to be recorded or a third party to be present. So why is that clear from the face of the rule?
Well, I think we have to, if the defendant truly has the right to obtain a examination of the plaintiff by the expert of their choosing in the time, place, and manner of that they specify, that we have to read into that that it's a meaningful evaluation. For it to be a meaningful evaluation, I think we have to presume that the experts are going to perform the evaluation in a manner consistent with standards of practice. Some standards of practice are not going to balk one way and the other about a request for a third-party observer or a recording device. Others, like a neuropsychologist, are. If there is a plaintiff who wants to impose conditions on a medical examination that the defendant's entitled to that are different than that which the medical professional thinks is appropriate, then the plaintiff can move for the protective order, which is the relief that is mentioned in the rule in order to do that. And the comments to the rules specifically state that it is the burden of the non-compliant party to move the court for a protective order to show why their non-compliance meets the good cause standard. So I think both the presumption that the medical professional will perform their medical evaluation in accordance with good practice, the fact that the rule itself states that the relief that a non-compliant party has available to them is the rule for protective order, and the fact that the comments say specifically, the word burden is in the comments where it says that it's the non-compliant party's burden to move the court if they want to impose conditions or otherwise avoid a Rule 4:19 examination as it is presented to them. The fact
it says as it is presented to them?
It doesn't say as it is presented to them, but that's part of, I mean, that's part of what the rule entitles the defendant to do.
But generally, lawyers work out the logistics.
Almost always.
Like that. You've got to show up on a particular date, time, and or you're done.
No, Your Honor. And again, I would again go back to the fact that it's not coincidental that two of these three cases that actually bring us up to the New Jersey Supreme Court level are cases that deal with neuropsychology. There is a trend that is noted in the literature, in the neuropsychological literature, of plaintiff's attorneys around this country routinely starting to ask for TPO or recording devices of neuropsychological evaluations specifically because they know a lot of the best neuropsychologists won't perform those evaluations under those conditions. I think it's included in Plaintiff's Appendix at 64. The update on third-party observers and neuropsychological evaluations, an interorganizational position paper, reads, demands for TPO in the context of medico-legal or forensic settings have become a tactic designed to limit the ability of the consulting neuropsychologist to perform assessment and provide information to the trier of fact. It's a concerted effort to try to get the most qualified neuropsychologists out of litigated cases. And the main reason is the fact that those validity scales that are in the examinations that defense counsel neuropsychologists routinely perform and plaintiffs neuropsychologists routinely do not perform that will give us objective evidence of when a plaintiff is trying to influence the results by underperforming purposefully on the tests. And again, this is something that if we were given a reciprocal right to record or have a third-party observer the plaintiff's neuropsych evaluations, that would mitigate the results to some extent, but it would also lower the bar for us all, and we would all be stuck with less than aspirational standard practicing neuropsychologists. And other than that, I'll rely on my papers and the arguments unless there are further questions, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Murray.
Thank you.
Ms. Murray.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. The De Leon matter that is before the court is the only of the three matters before the court that deals with an orthopedic examination rather than a neuropsych examination. It's our position that the appellate division decision should be upheld and that the burden should remain with the plaintiff on why, on a case-by-case basis, a third-party observer should be allowed in an orthopedic examination. And the reason for that is that the plaintiff is in the proper position to set forth to the court why a third-party observer should be allowed in each case. It is the plaintiff's attorney and the plaintiff that know of cognitive difficulties, of memory issues, of things such of that nature. In the De Leon matter, the only issue set forth before the court was the fact that Ms. De Leon was not a native English speaker. That was solved by the fact that we set up a interpreter through a third party that has no interest in this case so that the interpreter would be there to interpret on behalf of Ms. De Leon. There was never anything set forth that there were any cognitive difficulties or memory issues by Ms. De Leon that would render her the right to have a third-party observer present during the orthopedic examination. I respectfully disagree with the position set forth by some of the plaintiffs that by shifting this burden, there's going to be a floodgate of litigation before the trial courts. Previously, the burden fell on the defendants to file motions to compel unaccompanied examinations in the few instances where plaintiff's attorneys decided that third-party observers should be sent to orthopedic examinations. Now it just simply shifts that burden over to the plaintiff's bar, who is, again, in a better position to set forth why, in a certain situation, circumstances exist to justify the fact that a third-party observer should be present during an orthopedic examination. Further, an orthopedic examination is not akin to a neuro examination. Physical observations are often made by doctors. They're documented by doctors. Someone simply sitting in the room observing cannot take note of a doctor's personal observations of the exam. It's not a simple question and answer session as takes place in a neuropsych exam where note-taking would make more sense. Finally, as set forth by the amici today, these are not silent observers. As was admitted by the amici brief argument, these nurses may interfere. So what happens if a nurse, for instance, is disagreeing with what the defense doctor is doing during an examination? Are we now calling judges as we do in depositions during a defense IME? It's going to burden the courts further to allow an adversarial process between a nurse observer and a defense doctor to take place during an examination. Finally, there are protections in place for plaintiffs. They have favorable experts. They can cross-examine the defense experts. They receive the reports. And the plaintiffs themselves, such as Ms. De Leon, who has no cognitive difficulties known to the defense, can refute anything set forth in the defense exam that she does not agree with. At the amici for NJAJ brings up that defense exams often issue reports that have the same findings over and over again. What a wonderful tactic for the plaintiff to use to set forth those reports before the expert on cross-examination and show that they're not a reliable expert. These are all protections that are in place for the plaintiff's bar that do not require or justify the existence of a third-party observer during an examination. And finally, it should be noted that defendants will be further, the pool of defense experts that can be used will be further reduced if we're allowed to have third-party observers in a room when doctors are not allowing them to be present. If the court has nothing else, I'll rely on my papers.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Miller.
Good afternoon. Thank you again. May it please the court. The position of the Board of Psychological Examiners is that the appellate division worked at and got it right, that this case-by-case evaluation that allows for the development of a record as to whether a third-party observer should be permitted may, in fact, be the appropriate one. Judge Sabatino, in his opinion, had written there should be, you know, no absolute right nor an absolute bar to that, and it was to enable a trial judge to discern whether the types of situations that might warrant an observer or the presence of someone else could be established that way. For instance, an interpreter, a young child, a person who's cognitively impaired. There may be reasons why those are there. I think it's important sometimes to note that among the tools, the vehicles that are available to neuropsychologists, and I asked the court that our focus or the Board of Psychological Examiners' focus was specifically on neuropsychological testing and examination. They have tests that based on performance, you know, can we even give these tests and have the person who's responding to these this testing understand, whether by language or an ability to impair, as well as tests that test for symptom availability. Is there really a brain disorder? Is there really something going on physically that also may manifest in this type of cognitive impairment? The goal, obviously, of any experts that are retained by either side would be to help the trier of fact. And the Board of Psychological Examiners has advanced the position consistent with the documents that have been presented through, for instance, the American Board of Professional Neuropsychology, or even the subsequent papers that have come out in that way, is that the testing that's done is more valid, if you will, or has a greater, you know, has a more likely to be valid if the normative standards under which these tests were developed have been followed. And research has shown, or at least the citations at the end of these papers has shown, that the presence of a person, or indeed even the recording of these types of things, can affect both the examinee and the examiner and the conduct in which that's been done. And again, if you what the board is saying is one would hope or expect that the trier of fact want into the record the most valid, the most reasonable, the most thoughtful presentations based on those types of things. The Board of Psychological Examiners does not take a position on whose burden it should be or matters to that effect, but would only note that psychologists themselves have to exercise their professional judgment. And if they determine, when they hear if the court says these are the conditions under which this examination must proceed, the individual licensee must determine whether, in his, her, or their assessment, the examination can be properly done and would be valid, or whether that examination would violate the standards that professional has himself, herself, or themselves decided was necessary in order for the exam to take place. I would just note that...
Question for you. Sorry. Ms. Miller, are these standards entirely focused on the validity of the results, or are there concerns about ethics issues, or really professional ethics issues of someone who's conducting an examination as sensitive as this, allowing other people in the room? See what I'm saying? Is it all about results, or are there other concerns that are addressed?
I believe, Justice Patterson, that all comes into play. It's sort of a mix that, to the extent that the standards under which these tests were developed did not contemplate certain factors, then the test results themselves may be objective, again, less valid or brought more quickly into question. On the other hand, there are also the APA, the American Psychological Association guidelines that talk about different people's responsibilities, that different licensees' responsibilities to ensure that the manner in which they're dealing with people is appropriate. So, one of the things that was raised in a reply brief to the brief we filed in this court was that a person can consent. A plaintiff, for instance, could consent to have someone there. Well, that's really not the issue. I mean, obviously a neuropsychologist at the outset of a defense arranged exam would say, you have been brought in to have this evaluation. It's being done at the behest of your attorney. This is the limitations of this. This is what I'm going to be doing. These are the people with whom I'm going to be sharing it. What you say to me today is going to result in the following things. The consent that really we're talking about here is the consent of the licensee to, in his, her, or their, again, professional judgment, says, yes, I can proceed. Having a neutral interpreter of language is appropriate because Mr. Jones does not speak the language well. You know, Mrs. Miller has significant dementia, and she may not be able to do that. The Wellerman case, the seven-year-old child who was injured when the child was three, the need for a person to be in the room. Now, a neuropsychologist who's conducting both the interview as well as the testing that goes along with these neuropsych evaluations can say, under these circumstances, yes, I can proceed with this. But it is also my responsibility as a neuropsychologist to identify what deviations occurred, why they occurred, how they may have affected this assessment, and what limitations are in light of the need to have someone else in the room, in light of the need to have had this observation. That's pretty much the best we can say. It's a milieu that has come because these are folks, the neuropsychologists. There are 4,166 licensed psychologists in New Jersey as of today. My friend texted me. And I will say that several hundred actually have achieved the subspecialty training to be neuropsychologists. There are limited numbers of neuropsychologists, and the position papers that are in the record have an impact. They will have an impact on whether someone decides to take an engagement. And to that extent, I would also note that were a trial court to impose conditions pursuant to an evaluation that the trial court does, and Justice Patterson, you've indicated these motions happen all the time. Counsel on both sides have suggested that there is cooperation and when things can be done. And now I've lost my train of thought. To the extent that...
you were saying that if the court...
The court orders... Thank you, Judge. Justice. To the extent the court orders conditions, then it's going to be up to Dr. Jones to decide, I won't accept that engagement under those conditions. And that goes to Mr. Murray's point that there may be a diminution in the number. It's not a sky is falling moment as perhaps plaintiffs have suggested. But there may be a reduction in the number of neuropsychologists licensed in the state of New Jersey who are willing to accept engagements depending upon the extent of the conditions. And so the board's request to the court, again, finding that the appellate division, I think, tried to get it right, no absolute yeses and no absolute noes, but to understand to the extent that there are conditions there, the professional standards will have an impact on people's decisions to take an engagement, to accept to be an expert for this. And I would expect that everyone in this room and any all of the judges and trial judges on the bench want the best information available so that the truth at the end of the day will come out. And that's where we are.
One last question. Would you anticipate that if a court were to focus on a case and issue a sort of case-specific ruling on this, that would ameliorate some of these concerns? In other words, the neuropsychologist has a court order and can say on cross, on direct, or whatever, I was not permitted under the court order in this case to conduct this exactly as I would have otherwise. However, here's what I did to address that issue.
A person could certainly, and a licensee could certainly decide that she would complete the evaluation under the conditions imposed by the court, presumably would during testimony say, because of this observation or recording, there may be some change to what might otherwise have done. I have used all my skills to try to mitigate the deviations or to try to figure out how that would affect it, and I'm giving my best possible opinion. So could a neuropsychologist say this exam was conducted under conditions ordered by the court? Yes, and maybe under normal circumstances I wouldn't have profess it. I think that, and I don't want to jump ahead, and this may not be anyone's question, but to the extent that the board has said, and said out loud, that the existence of a court order would not insulate a neuropsychologist from board review of that psychologist's actions, certainly stands. We're not going to take that. How it impacts.
The board ever take an action against neuropsychologist?
A neuropsychologist, this issue has never come up before the board, so it's completely hypothetical. And the reason why I say it now is there were two cases which we cited both in the appellate division and here where the Board of Psychological Examiners found that psychologists, not neuropsychologists in the context of testing, but had violated, say, conflicts of interest rules of the profession in custody evaluations. And the board can step in there and say, we are looking at this whole thing, and we think you didn't get it right in this case. And I would say, from my years of working with the professional boards, the majority of matters or complaints that come before the boards don't result in disciplinary action. It just doesn't happen. But the board has the ability to look into it. And so, for instance, if the board were to receive, the Board of Psychological Examiners, this is kind of a crazy example, but I'm going to go out there for the sides. I'm going to do a neuropsychological evaluation of Mrs. Smith, and I'm going to live stream it on Facebook. I mean, clearly that would be way beyond what anybody would ever contemplate was responsible or appropriate under standards of practice of how neuropsych exams, particularly if the neuropsychologist were to say, and I'm going to share my screen so you can see all the questions. Now, everybody follow along with me. We're going to see how we do a neuropsych exam. That would be troubling to the professional board. And so, again, crazy example, way out there, not what's happening. But in terms of assessing professional judgment that has been exercised, that's the lane of the board to take a look at that. Certainly a court order would be a factor that was considered and potentially even weighed heavily. The record developed at the trial court that said there is a reason why, again, Mrs. Smith, Mrs. Jones needs to have someone in there is something that the board would consider. And the board would also then look at the report. Did the psychologist, neuropsychologist take into account what the conditions were? How did it impact? How did that factor into the report that was ultimately done? Did it change the tests that were used? And what was the reason for doing that? Hasn't happened.
You're placing great reliance on the 2016 policy statement, of course. I want to ask you what we asked Mr. Murray to respond to. It relies, among the references here, are for recording devices, a 2002 study by Constantino about an audio recorder, a 2005 study by Constantino about a video camera. Have these studies been updated to account for changes in technology that have created far more unobtrusive devices over the last 15 plus years?
I first preface it by saying that the 2021 paper by another three entities supported those original considerations that recording would be bad.
They rely on the same data studies?
They generally do, and that the most recent paper that was appended to Ms. Vesluharvey's papers from a 2022 American Psychological Association also suggested that, you know, these types of situations, recording or observation, not be done. The research that I was able to do prior to this did not come up with anything specific that's new, and clear what I did find when we were researching back in the last several months was that observation seems more problematic than recording, but I can't stand here, and suggest that I have the ability, the background to make any kind of statement as to whether or not recording is still the same or not the same, other than people seem to not have published a paper, at least I didn't find any, that said even recording was that. And again, it falls back to an awareness by the examinee that he is being observed, and how the particular professional might be administering the exams. I just don't have anything further.
What would be the concrete rule that the neuropsychologist would have violated that the board would be taking action against them for if the neuropsychologist were to abide by a court order and allow a third-party observer or allow a recording?
So I think I understand your concern, Justice. I think what I would say is that there is a rule. The board does have a rule that says tests must be administered pursuant to the technical manuals that accompany the test. So to the extent those technical manuals would generally say they should not be observed or recorded, that's actually a specific rule. There is also a rule among the Board of Psychological Examiners rules talk about the need to stay abreast of standards and policies and things like that. And standards of practice, they have to maintain competence consistent with their professional responsibilities. Those who use psychometric components are required to have coursework in those psychometric components, so they're expected to have continued to be up to date on all of those, and they must observe relevant professional standards. Those professional standards will be discerned from review of papers like the ABN paper and other papers. The board's ability to investigate, however, isn't just limited to a specific rule. It's overall, how is the psychologist, or in this case, a neuropsychologist, what has he or she done that would cause the board concern? Again, overarching responsibility, protect the public health, safety, and welfare. Does the conduct of a particular psychologist and the manner in which they have conducted themselves under these circumstances result in concern for any other reasons? Has the violation of a board regulation is a specific basis for discipline under the Uniform Enforcement Act. That's at 45-121H. But if a licensee were to engage in professional misconduct, if a licensee were to engage in negligence, if a licensee were to engage in gross malpractice, if a licensee were to have, there are 15 or 20 different specific ideas or limits in the Uniform Enforcement Act that give that basis for discipline. So to your question, is there a specific rule? There is a specific rule that talks about testing. There's not a specific rule that talks about recording or observing these types of evaluations. So to the extent that I would rely or ask the court to look at our brief, to the extent Metro Media is brought into the picture, I'm going to say that we've been analyzed and said why Metro Media would not require a specific rule at this time.
But you're saying that the way this would all potentially play out is the general standards that require adherence with the professional standards would dovetail with the standards that talk about the validity of results being affected by the presence of another person in the room, to use that example.
Yes, Justice.
And so there could be a situation where there is potentially an impact on the, maybe not the license, but the standing of the expert.
I'm sorry, I just didn't hear.
There might be a situation where it could affect the, not necessarily the licensing of the expert, but the standing of the expert in the field, which
yes.
may deter people from participating in litigation.
Yes. So other than, I'm certainly happy to answer any other questions the court has, but again, like most mindful of that, I would just note that there's not, everyone keeps talking about B.D. Carley as having been the gold standard and everybody should go back to that. I've read it a few times. I know what the appellate division said, but it just referred to a psychological examination. It didn't refer to a neuropsychological examination. There are very, very few facts that talked about the extent to which the plaintiff in that situation needed to be examined. I don't know what the psychologist had been demanding or how it would have worked. I think that the appellate division's sense that a trial judge would be in a good place to assess the needs and the respective interests of the parties is a place where this court may wish to land. Might also wish to land in a civil practice committee referral. You folks know that better than I would ever dream to. I've not participated in litigation in the personal injury realm. Can't speak to that, and counsel on both sides have done that, I think, well this afternoon. I'm happy if there's anything else.
Thank you, Ms. Moore.
Thank you so much.
Ms. O'Brien, you have the last say today.
Thank you, Chief Justice, Associate Justices, and may it please the court. I want to thank you for allowing the New Jersey Defense Association to appear today as amicus. I will endeavor to adhere to the court's suggestion of brevity in today's arguments, keeping in mind that a lot of the wind has been taken out of my sails already today. It is respectfully submitted by the NJDA that the appellate division's opinion preserves the use of Rule 419 as a discovery tool in providing an adverse party with a fair opportunity to develop expert evidence. This is an outcome which we deem to be logical, fair, and in the interest of justice, and as such, we respectfully submit that the appellate division's undertaking to clarify, update, and in some respects revise BD versus Carley should not be disturbed. Particularly, as Justice Patterson pointed out earlier this afternoon, much has changed in the 20-plus years since BD Carley and the prevalence of medical examinations in our litigation. This is obviously a direct result of both advancements in medicine, as well as a result of the identification, diagnosis, and treatment or recovery from things like concussions and traumatic brain injuries, and of course their increased presence in the legal landscape. The NJDA takes the position that Rule 419 provides clear guidance as to procedures for addressing third-party attendance and recording of physical examinations of a plaintiff. Practically, the deviation from the procedures set forth in the rule have resulted in an inappropriate shifting of the burden to the defendant, which was both acknowledged and thoroughly addressed by the appellate division's opinion. As a result of this opinion, clarity has been afforded to both litigants and to the trial court judges alike. This case-by-case analysis is appropriate and addresses the questions about fairness, fairness of the defense present at defense at plaintiff's exams. The appellate court confirmed that procedurally a plaintiff must affirmatively make an application to the trial court in order to deviate from the standard practice of unattended, unrecorded examinations requested by the defense, and that the burden rests on a plaintiff to establish good cause or special circumstances for any requests, conditions, or circumstances related to the medical examinations permitted by Rule 419. It is respectfully submitted on behalf of the Defense Association that the Appellate Division squarely addressed the principles and struck what it considers to be a balance between the competing interests that have been offered. The court's opinion provides a factual recount of the three matters consolidated for purposes of appeal, which Your Honors have heard and I will not get into, as well as the analysis of the procedural history of the rule and the case law in New Jersey, as well as other states. It succinctly enumerates six holdings adopted by the court as guidance, or what it calls gloss.
Question for you, counsel.
Sure.
If there is a presumption in plaintiff's favor, what is lost, if anything, in terms of the facts that are before the court? See what I'm saying? Because we heard from the Attorney General about the need for a court order, potentially, to protect someone, protect the expert. If there is a presumption that this is going to generally happen in certain categories, procedurally, what's lost in terms of the ability to put before the court the right facts?
Are you asking with respect to the recording or with respect to the
defense? Either one. I guess we focus, either one if there's a distinction between the two. See what I'm saying? The argument is there should be a presumption. That would mean that the defendant would have the burden of proving that there was a need to not have certain factors that the plaintiff wants.
Sure. I mean, looking at our argument advances essentially that 419 provides a safeguard for plaintiffs, assumes a presumption that these are unrecorded, unattended because of the language suggesting a protective order or a motion to dismiss if the exam is not conducted as requested by the defense under 419.
So do you disagree with counsel on the other side that said that basically for the past 20 years under the prior appellate division decision that these medical exams had been happening accompanied? You seem to be saying that the presumption is that the standard is that they're always unattended. But the other side said, no, the standard is that they have always been attended. And now all of a sudden it's a change that this appellate division decision has wrought. So which is factually correct?
So our position is that the rule 419, its plain language, doesn't afford that opportunity. It simply allows a defense examination to proceed. And I would submit that
what had been happening on the ground?
I think it depends on the case. I think the case-by-case analysis determination that was struck by the appellate division is appropriate because I do think in certain cases there was an agreement between the parties, between the counsel. I mean, very often there is consent. I know this has been alluded to by several of the other attorneys before, so it wasn't an issue. I think that obviously, I haven't been practicing necessarily as long as some of the other people have argued here today. My experience has been that in a lot of my cases, it's not an issue, but there is a prevalence of notifying defense in response to the scheduling of an examination, an intent to preservation of an intent or an intent to preserve the right to be able to do those things. And the burden has then inappropriately shifted to the defense to then make the motion for protective order. This examination should not go through with X, Y, and Z set forth in your form letter that we received in response to our scheduling notice. So I think it's the types of cases that the attorneys deal with. It may be more prevalent in perhaps medical malpractice cases. I know some of the other attorneys suggested in more catastrophic injury cases, there's less of a opposition to having a recording and or an attendant there, particularly when there are, more complex medical issues. I think the big thing is you look to the NCAA, the NFL, all of them have advanced the protocols with respect to traumatic brain injuries, with respect to concussions, the protocols that are involved. I think that has advanced, medicine has then advanced, and we're kind of the last people catching up with it as these injuries reach the court steps. So I think that over time it's becoming more of an issue, but I think logistically or practically speaking, the objections to them are arising more often because they're being more of a blanket warning, if you will, from the response to noticing these examinations, at least in my practice. So it is respectfully submitted that the court's opinion provides this factual recount. It succinctly enumerates the six holdings that we've discussed that were adopted as what the court called gloss on Rule 419. And therefore, the NJDA respectfully submits that its holdings should not be disturbed. I understand if the court has any questions, I'm happy to address them. But in the interest of time, I would defer.
Thank you, Ms. O'Brien. Thank you to all counsel.